This is Jonathan Lane from Fan Film Factor, and today I'm very excited to have as my guest J.G. Hertzler. Yes, General Martok himself from Deep Space Nine. He's also been in Star Trek Voyager. He's been in Enterprise. He's been in about a million different Star Trek video games. He did a fan film back in 2006-2007 called Star Trek of Gods and Men, where he played a Klingon, and I'm sure most of you know him also as Admiral Sam Travis in Prelude to Axanar. And most recently, he was a candidate for the United States House of Representatives in the 23rd District of New York. And while I usually make it a point not to discuss politics on Fan Film Factor, well, today I really have no choice, so we're going to step on the third rail. Anyway, J.G., welcome.
Well, thanks. Thanks, man. The third rail is, it's not that much of a third rail over here in upstate New York, in the Finger Lakes region. The congressional district that I was running in is 11 counties, stretching all the way along the Pennsylvania border from Lake Erie all the way to Tioga County, and then north to Tompkins County, all the way to the top of Seneca Lake, a little town called Geneva, which is in Ontario County, but doesn't include all of Ontario County, which I believe goes all the way up to Lake Ontario.
Folks, if you want to picture a map of New York State in your mind or bring it up on your internet browser, the 23rd District pretty much covers that straight horizontal border with Pennsylvania, right, that is most of, you know, the western half of New York State. It goes right from there up about halfway, and it's a very interesting district. I know it well because I actually went to Cornell University, which is in that district. But most of it is just, it's farmland. It's a lot of very conservative area, you know, folks and blue-collar folks and the glasswork people who work in Corning and Elmira. And then right there at the top is Ithaca, which is a city of about 30,000 people, or when college is in session, about 60,000 people. And it's got Cornell University. It's got Ithaca College. It's very, very, very liberal. So you've got pretty much a red and blue district. It's kind of crazy up there, isn't it?
Well, it's not red and blue. Tompkins is the blue county. The rest is very red. Even though the far western county, Chautauqua, has Jamestown in it, which is an old Union town. It's mainly known for Lucille Ball's. She was born there, and there's a museum and a theater. There's a huge complex they're just building now for Lucille Ball. And you know what's odd about this connection? Lucille Ball was not only born in my district that I was running for Congress for, but she was the person who greenlit for Desilu Productions, greenlit the first Star Trek in 1966.
Thank you, Lucy.
Isn't that something? Yeah. So I don't know if Desi Arnaz was part of it or not, but I know Lucille Ball was. And I always wanted to do a production of, there's a book called The Creator about Roddenberry. And it's a wonderful book. If you haven't read it, please pick it up and read it. It's thick, it's big, but it's very rich with stories and news about the beginnings of Star Trek and what Hollywood was like back in 1966. And that's why I wanted Major Roddenberry, when she was still with us, to play the role of Lucille Ball, green lighting Star Trek. I thought that would be a terrific, she would have been terrific as Lucy. And
she totally could have pulled that off.
Absolutely. Anyway, that's just a strange side note.
Okay, well back to the third rail, though, because first of all, I want folks to understand a little bit more about the district. Right now, the incumbent is Tom Reed, and he has been the representative for your district, I think, since 2012. He's also in Congress before that, but the district, as it's drawn currently, was drawn that way in 2012. Now, his first election was kind of a squeaker. He only won, like, by 52% to 48%, but the last two elections, he's cruised to, like, a 20-point victory. So one would say that he's a strong incumbent.
Yeah, he had the incumbent going for him after the first election. He ran against Nate Shinagawa, who almost won because Nate was incredibly likable, but he just couldn't pull it off against the – it's an overpowering red district. To tell you the truth, I don't know the exact numbers, but I think it's like 1.2 or 3% to 1.3 to 1, the number of Republicans versus Democrats, and that's if everybody comes out. And I've been a Democrat for 45 years. I mean, I first canvas for McGovern in the mountains of around Scranton, Pennsylvania, in Polish neighborhoods where no English was spoken. It was Polish, and I was trying to explain as a senior in college. I went to Bucknell, which is down in Pennsylvania. I was trying to explain the horror of the carpet bombing in Cambodia by Nixon, and you know, the people didn't really speak English. So it was, first of all, here I am, this 20-year-old, trying to explain major U.S. foreign policy to non-English speaking, non-usually non-voters, and to support George McGovern. So that was my introduction. And I stuck with the Democrats for 45 years. I'm very dissatisfied with Hillary. I was very dissatisfied with Tom Perez being appointed Democratic National Committee chairman. I think Keith Ellison is brilliant, but I think he was the wrong choice as well. You've got a bridge. You pick two people that are really, what's it called, the third rail candidates for the moderate and the right-wing people. You're never going to get their votes. So that's why I ran as a the local Democratic Party was not my friend either. The first thing somebody said to me, the vice chairman of the Democratic Party here in Tompkins County said, first of all, I got to tell you, John, that we're never going to support a Democratic candidate from this county in this district. And I said, well, that's pretty much of a downer. What do you mean? And they just said, well, they can't win, and we're not going to support that person. So that's when I said, well, that's the last straw. I'll become an independent. And I wanted to run a campaign that was not identifiable as a political campaign. And I succeeded in that. Unfortunately, I didn't get enough signatures. In order to get on the ballot as an independent candidate, not only do you have to create your own party, you can't just put your name on there and with an I, and you can't do it, you know, with the independent. You have to create a party. So I created this Bill of Rights Party, which I thought was, since the first 10 amendments are really what created this country in terms of rights. And because of that, the people didn't know what the Bill of Rights Party was. And largely, although I had a lot more name recognition than most any other political candidate in this district because of Star Trek, I still couldn't get the sufficient number of signatures. I needed about 5,000 to 6,000 signatures that could be verified and pass the challenges. And I just couldn't get it. I didn't have enough volunteers to be able to go out and do it. And to tell you the truth, even though my heart was definitely in changing the will of Congress, because the whole Trump mentality, I don't care who he was, Mr. Strzok or Mr. Comey or whomever is now, you know, writing, John Brennan, or is it John Brennan, the former, is it Richard Brennan?
For John Brennan, the former CIA director who had his clearance revoked as we have our interview is on Friday, so it was just a couple of days ago.
Oh, man, wow.
By the way, anybody waiting for us to talk about Axanar, it will be coming. But right now, JG, you know, having been a congressional candidate, this is very interesting stuff. I mean, you obviously know a lot about his history as an actor, but getting to know JG as a politician, I think, is absolutely fascinating. So we can.
Well, my life has been, I mean, I had two major interests. One is politics and current events, and the other is theater. And I came to theater much later than I came to politics. I was in law school for a year at American University Law School after graduating in political science at Bucknell, and I was working for the federal government for a year and a half when I became, it's a long story and I won't go into it, but I started attending law school at American University, Washington School of Law, and I fully intended to be a lawyer or for the purpose of running for office. Because they're all lawyers in Congress, unless you're a billionaire, then you can be a congressman as well. Which brings me back to Tom Reed. You said I was going to put in there, remember it's the, quote, honorable Tom Reed. Tom Reed's an excellent politician because he successfully lands on both sides of every issue. He divides it, he bifurcates it by, this is what I intellectually believe, and this is what I emotionally believe. He separates his life into so he can be yes on emotional and no on intellectual. And that's a very convenient thing. But the biggest thing is he's a major supporter. He's in New York. He's a major supporter of Trump. The other major supporter was Chris Collins, who was just indicted or arrested, I should say, for insider trading. You know, he's going to go to trial, and Trump's going to pardon him and his son and everybody else. Trump's going to pardon anybody that's his friend and gets in trouble. So that's a joke. That part of our justice system is now a joke because Trump's in office.
But Tom Reed and Chris Collins were actually very close to each other. When Chris Collins was arrested, I remember seeing on CNN just like a few hours later that night, Tom Reed. I'd never actually seen him on TV before, but suddenly, you know, he is up there talking, you know, as a Republican. Yeah. And if you're an adjacent county, the county just north right. of yours is right. the north, Buffalo, you know, New York 27th is north Chris Collins right. County.
Yeah, and it just sits right on top of ours. This should tell you who Tom Reed is. He's a lawyer. His law firm specialized in medical debt collection. That's what they did. And he is the biggest supporter in this state supporter of Trump against universal health care, against single-payer health insurance. Because if we were able to have single-payer health insurance, his law firm would be out of business. And people don't understand that. Trump lies right out to people, and Tom Reed backs him up. To me, they have no honor whatsoever. And that's why I say we have to change the will of Congress. I don't know. I don't have the answer to everything, as I would say to people. I said, but where there's a will, there's a way. And I've spent my life in one of the most difficult businesses there is, show business. It's 98% unemployment in this business, and I have been very lucky and I've worked hard, and I was able to have a family and have a house, and that's it. You know, I'm never going to get rich in this business. Lord knows I'm in debt, but I wasn't running on a specific. The specificity of issues were several. One was get out of the Middle East, and I read a thing today. In the paper about Trump, he's cutting back money that was going to the anti-IS campaign in Syria. What the article was basically saying is he's withdrawing the U.S. from Syria. And I hope that we can withdraw from the entire Middle East, because what have we accomplished in 18 years of war? What have we accomplished? We've accomplished creating a lot more people in that area that hate everything associated with the United States of America. We have not made it safe for democracy. We have not improved the life of any of these people. What have we accomplished except lost a lot of blood, a lot of people killed on all sides? Bring our troops out of there. Use that money in America to get we should have an Apollo-sized program to get off fossil fuels. And it should be very clear, with two-thirds of California on fire, it should be very clear that we are in a new stage of existence. And if we don't get off fossil fuels and get onto alternative energies with an Apollo-sized mentality, meaning we got to the moon in 7 years, I think, after Kennedy said we're going there, all it did was cost Kennedy his life, you know, but it was a mission that America believed in, and we did it, and we got people on the moon in 7 years. Are you telling me we can't shift over to alternative fuels, which are manifold variations all over the world? There's tests and development going in every country in the world, and we can't make that transition in less than 50 years? You know, it blows my mind, and that's the kind of thing. Trump and Reed are a big supporter. Reed's a big supporter of fossil fuels, of coal mining and oil and methane. I'm not running anymore because I couldn't get the signatures. I couldn't inspire enough people to put their name on the bottom line to be able to get my name on the ballot. So, you know, in a way, I have nowhere to talk. I tried, but I couldn't get there.
Well, I mean, this doesn't mean you have to shut up. It just means that you can't, you know, do it from the floor of the House of Representatives, at least not right now.
Oh, believe me. Yeah, you're right. I have no intention of shutting up. I have intention. We're talking. My better half is an ACLU attorney, and we are looking at several programs. If we can bring lawsuits to change some of these policies, we're going to do it. To juxtapose the Statue of Liberty which was the image of my Bill of Rights Party, to juxtapose the Statue of Liberty and the children in cages in Texas is unconscionable. And that should be the poster child for the Democratic Party in running against Trump immediately. Anyway.
Well, it seems to me, just, you know, reading all of my political blogs, because even though I typically don't talk politics on Fan Film Factor when I'm not blogging
right.
about Star Trek, I'm reading political blogs.
Right.
It looks like what the Democrats are doing this year is they're running on local issues. You know, Trent Lott once said, all politics is local. And or is it loco? You know, it's local issues. So, you know, you've got Cortez over there in Queens saying that we should abolish ICE, but that's not going to get Connor Lamb reelected in Pennsylvania. You know, he's in a very conservative district, so he can come out for Second Amendment rights, and he can come out against abortion. You know, there's candidates running in Kentucky who are, you know, very, very conservative blue dog Democrats, because if you are not, you're not going to win in Kentucky. And I think...
Yeah, well, it's exactly right. That's why I had a problem with the Democratic Party nominating and creating Tom Perez as the chairman and Keith Ellison as the vice chairman. I said, right away, you're alienating people that want to say, no, wait a minute, this is America. We have to work together. These people are radical to the left. My position on Second Amendment, for instance, was the Second Amendment is in the Bill of Rights. It guarantees and protects our right to bear arms. It does not protect the arms we bear. That has got to be left up to the legislatures and the judiciary, either of the federal government or the individual states. But it should be clear to people that the Second Amendment is not going anywhere. It was put there for a reason, and we need it there. But it does not determine technology. That's got to be up to as the country progresses, that's got to be up to the country that lives in the moment, not in 200 years in the past.
Well, also, along with the Second Amendment, I'd like to point out that there's also the First Amendment. And
exactly.
The First Amendment allows for freedom of speech, which is something that the President of the United States doesn't really seem to, you know, like right now, as he wants
really?
To shut down media outlets. And, you know, he's basically come out and said, you know, I want to be able to sue news organizations for doing their job.
It's astounding. I'm older than you, but I've never seen anything like this. I never thought it would be... I mean, I was in the Nixon administration when Nixon was going down, and I was working for the federal government in the newly created EPA. And every morning we would come in to read Bernstein and Woodward and Bernstein in the Washington Post and say, oh, my Lord, look at this. And I knew that I'd seen that safe in E. Howard Hunt's office. I'd seen the safe where he had the cash. You know, this was all true, and everybody that was working in the federal government right next to the executive office building, we knew this. And I was in making a tape for the Democratic Party in the Watergate, in the studio, which is immediately adjacent to where they broke in, the plumbers broke in, the day before. I was there the night before the day that it happened. And anyway... I don't know why I'm saying all this. The purpose, the thing is, I have a history. I'm 68 now, 68, and I've seen a lot. And so many of us, it's as if there is no history. We're not taught history. We're not taught government. We're not taught the Constitution. We're not taught civics in our schools anymore. And if I hear one more Laura Ingraham advertisement for Hillsdale College, where they teach really basically fascism...
God.
That's my opinion. In the name of patriotism. You know, Mark Twain said it. He said, you know, patriotism is basically a love of your country always, and a love of your government when they deserve it. So because I'm only doing Mark because I announced my candidacy as Mark Twain.
I was going to ask you about that, by the way, so thanks for bringing that up. So, yeah, so you were actually running, or you're going to run, as both J.G. Hertzler and as American author Mark Twain.
Mark was my spokesman.
Okay, so that's how, because obviously your name appeared or was going to appear on the ballot as J.G. Hertzler, not Mark Twain. So when people
correct.
Went and, you know, listened to you talk, they're like, okay, well, I want to vote for Mark Twain or Samuel Clemens. This is Mark Twain's real name. And they don't see you on the ballot. Who are they going to know to vote for?
Well, that was a further complication that I'm responsible for. I wanted to run a non-political campaign, and I did that. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it was impossible to identify my campaign, what it was at all. And that might have been part of my problem. But the second problem is, well, the reason for it was that Mark Twain was from this district. Mark Twain, you know, although he was born in Hannibal, Mo, Missouri, he lived in Elmira. He wrote for 20 years. He wrote most of the major works that he did in a little octagonal gazebo-like place in just outside of Elmira in the mountains. It's still there. It is a beautiful home. He married a Langdon, and that their Langdon house was up in these mountains outside of Elmira, where he could look down from that little gazebo on the top of that mountain and look down and see the Chemung River that was navigable by steamboats back in the day. And he could sit there and write Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer. You know, even though he's talking about the steamboats on the Mississippi, where he was a captain for a year, I think, he could see the reincarnation of those right there in front of him when he was writing. Anyway, because Mark had such an attachment, Sam Clemens had so much of an attachment to this district, I thought I would just borrow him, because mainly for one reason. He was able to do with humor what I would like to be able to do politically, and that's change minds, entertain people, and through humor rather than through vitriol. So anyway, I guess that's a sidebar to what I do. I'm not running anymore. I think I'm too old to run again, although I'm obviously still as activated. But I guess
you're younger than Donald Trump. He's going to run again.
Yeah, boy.
Yeah. Don't let them win. Don't let them win. Well, actually, I guess my biggest question, though, is the DCCC or the DNC, whichever was, you know, the one telling you that they weren't going to put any campaign money behind you, you know, pretty much was just going to write off New York 23 as, you know, it's just a red district, we can't win, so why throw money at it? And
yeah,
obviously, you know, Tom Reed is, you know, very well entrenched as an incumbent. The question now is, obviously, you were potentially going to draw some votes away if you had gotten on the ticket from the Democrats.
Correct.
So I'm sure that, you know, the party is not that upset that you suspended your campaign.
Oh, absolutely not.
But the question is, do you think that, especially with what just happened to Chris Collins just north of you, do you think that in a blue wave year that your district could potentially be in play, or is it pretty much just going to be still Tom Reed, maybe a little bit closer than usual, but he's just going to get reelected?
No, I don't think it'll even be close. The candidate is, although she claims to be from Yates County, she's really associated with Cornell University and Ithaca, and he's basically running a campaign, Tom Reed is, that we don't need any Ithaca liberals telling us how to live our lives in this. The district is not only farmland, it's mountains, and it's very sparsely populated. There's not a lot of people. And these really are Trump supporters. In my opinion, the poverty is unbelievable. And Trump was able to tell people that were living in poverty and were frustrated by, by the national political scene not looking at them, not paying attention to them. I keep hearing this in the news, that Trump appealed to the forgotten man. Well, the forgotten man, that first came up with Meet John Doe. Frank Capra, who was a Republican, by the way, but he was very, very, very liberal. Frank Capra made that movie, Meet John Doe, and it was a polemic against Republican elitism, I mean, the billionaires and corporatism and authoritarianism. It was about the little guy bonding together and rising up. But somehow Trump was able to, his people, and he were able to, appropriate that title, The Forgotten Man, and make it a Trumpian voter base. I don't think that's changed. I think they still feel like Trump is the only one speaking on their behalf, which is insane. But he's a great con man. and he's a tremendous liar, and he says things right out in the open. I could shoot a man in the middle of Fifth Avenue, and nobody would care because I'm rich. You know?
I often wonder, by the way, if he did go out and shoot somebody, what the Trump supporters would say. And, you know, and it wasn't just being funny. I was literally picturing if Donald Trump went out and shot somebody, that there would be so many people explaining why it was necessary for Trump to shoot that person.
Exactly, unless it was Mother Teresa. And even if it were Mother Teresa, there'd be something found about her that she deserved to be shot. She was about to do something awful. You know, I couldn't agree with you more. And that is the problem. There is no truth, verifiable truth, objective truth in news today. And that's a problem.
And that's true on the left and the right. I mean, I'm a big watcher of CNN, but even I cringe sometimes when I see, you know, three Democratic pundits and one, you know, Republican quote-unquote villain, you know, talking. And, you know, it's like, look, I do miss the days of, I'm not going to say real news, because I think, you know, there's a lot of real news out there, but when news was presented in a much more objective way so that you got all the facts and then you pretty much decided for yourself. Obviously, PBS still does that.
I can't remember his name right now, but who was the guy who ran, his son is a newscaster now, who ran Meet the Press for several years before he passed away?
Tim Russert?
Tim Russert. Tim Russert, he was, I think that was the downfall of objective truth, because Tim Russert took over, when I was growing up, there was Lawrence A. Spivak, and there were five other people or four other people. It really was Meet the Press. It wasn't one guy asking questions. It wasn't Tim Russert. It was five panelists, including Lawrence A. Spivak, who asked questions from all political angles. And that was Meet the Press. It became Meet Tim Russert. And that, I think, I've always objected to it. I said, that's where you went wrong, and that's where you turned off a lot of people, I think. And and you have to be a certain age to know that what came before. And because I was, you know, I was glued to the TV as a child, I know what came before. Anyway, I don't want to belabor that point. I agree with you. There is a bias both ways. I think, I mean, I've bet several people. I bet the wife of Bruce Boxleitner. I said, listen, I will bet you right now, because she was saying, oh, they all do it. They all lie. They all, both the left and the right. I said, look, I will bet you right now $1,000, and I cannot afford to lose $1,000. I will bet you right now that if you get a random hour by some objective judge, a random hour of Rachel Maddow versus a random hour of Sean Hannity, I will bet you $1,000 there will be many, 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 many more half-truths and lies under Sean Hannity than there will be under Rachel Maddow. I will put that money up right now. Nobody has ever taken me up on that bet. I'll do it again. I'll say it to you. I'll bet you $1,000 right now.
Well, except that I'd be on the same side as you, so we basically have $2,000 up against anybody who wanted to bet us.
Well, maybe there's a movement inherent somewhere in there, you could say.
Well, it's not just the lies, you know, and I mean, it's easy to say lies, it's easy to say fake news, but you know what, I have a very, very good friend, one of my best friends in the whole world, and he's a conservative. You know, as liberal as I am, you know, tinfoil wearing hat Jonathan, you know, he is a conservative guy. And he sends, we have the longest email debates you have ever seen.
Wow.
Which keeps us both on our toes. But, you know, he'll send me articles from the Wall Street Journal and editorials, and I'll read them. And I will pick out that one paragraph that's like 17 paragraphs down.
Right.
That sort of undermines the argument, but it's buried, it's hidden in there.
Right.
And I point to the fact, you know, I basically just pull this out, and I do this over and over and over again. I'll pull out that one paragraph that says, hey, did you notice this? Because he skims. And it's basically something that proves my point. And what my feeling is that when you create your version of the truth by giving 90% of everything that supports your argument, but leaving out 90% of what doesn't support your argument. So you only have 10% of that which is going to disprove what you say.
Useful.
It makes it easier to follow. I had this argument with my father-in-law last weekend. You know, he said, you know, look at what the Democrats have done, raising the taxes in California, and you're losing all of these big businesses. You know, businesses are fleeing California left and right. You know, I looked it up on the Internet, and what I discovered is that, yes, some very big companies have fled California because of the taxes. What I also discovered is that California is currently the number one state in growth of small businesses and the number two state behind only New York in growth of medium size and large, like billion-dollar or more corporations. You know, of all 50 states, we're either number one or number two in growth. But all my father-in-law saw was these very salient, you know, big companies leaving California because of the taxes, and that became the truth.
Well, you know, this is the thing. The difference between a liberal and a conservative is a conservative will point at somebody else and say, you're the problem. A liberal will say, we're both the problem. We have to fix it. And the other thing is this, a liberal's argument, Jerry Nadler came out, who's, if there's a blue wave, if the Democrats can take over the House, Jerry Nadler will very likely become the Speaker of the House. I'm done with Pelosi. I mean, Pelosi is from an old world backroom Baltimore smoke-filled room political family, the D'Alessandros. I don't know if you know this or not.
Yes, I do.
But Tommy D'Alessandro was the mayor of Baltimore. I met him when he was the honorary mayor of Baltimore. We walked around here because I was doing a show called Maryland, I'm from Maryland, largely. And I'm done with Pelosi. But Nadler came out with, after Trump won, Nadler came out with like a six-page memo he sent out to the Democratic Party of things that needed to be done, complicated. And I said, this is exactly the problem. First of all, the motto, stronger together, doesn't even have an actionable verb in it. You know, how can that be a cry, a rallying cry? Secondly, it became so complicated, what he said, that nobody can get behind it. You have to, what Trump, he was able to reduce things to the lowest and most accessible common denominator. Build a wall. Lock her up. Drain the swamp.
They all had verbs, you're right. They all had something and said this is an action item.
Absolutely. And it resonated. People with the lowest education level that didn't look at the world in complicated terms just said, look, I don't have enough to get by. I can't feed my family. Those people are unbelievably wealthy. I don't know how to say it any more than that. It was a simplified message that got through. And ours was much too complicated, and it didn't have any rallying position whatsoever. When I say ours, I mean the Democrats, when I used to be a Democrat. But now I'm just a Klingon. I'm advancing the Klingon philosophy to honor, sacrifice, and glory. That's what I'm after now.
Well, I'll tell you, I recently read a book called The Righteous Mind, and it defined one of the other basic differences between Democrats and Republicans or liberals and conservatives is a certain value judgment when it came to fairness. Nobody thinks that they are inherently unfair. Nobody thinks,
Absolutely.
I'm an unfair person. But it's the definition of fairness. So for liberals, the idea of fairness is, you know what, sometimes fate just deals you a bad hand.
Right.
And it's very difficult for you, for some people, to make it. And to be fair, if somebody has a lot, they should give some of that a lot to people who have a little. You know, the idea of, you know, there is no ultimate winner at the poker game. Nobody gets all of the chips. Let's all share.
Right.
Whereas for conservatives, the idea of fairness is don't take from other people who have worked so hard for what they've earned. So if my taxes are going to support, you know, some, you know, woman who's not working because she decided to have 28 children and she's, you know, a crackhead or whatever, why am I paying my money to support her? Why am I letting other people from poorer countries come in and take our jobs from hardworking Americans? So it's just your definition of fairness that in a lot of ways defines which party you're going to identify with.
This is what I would have to say. In that case, you show utter disrespect for the Constitution of the United States of America, because the first words are, "We the people, in order to form a more perfect union." You're living in a society. The Constitution was a document that was set up saying, this is how we're going to live together and lift everybody, lift all boats. That was the point.
That was the point, but hold on, JG. I'm gonna go back to 1787 with you, and we the people was actually we the white male people who own land. Back in the early days, blacks didn't even count as 3/5 of a person. Women were not allowed to vote, and the whole idea of the Electoral College is, there's a lot of dumb people out there, so we want the people electing the president to be the ones who at least know how to read and write the name of the candidate.
Right. You're right about that. The all those things, and the 27 amendments that have been made have been trying to rectify those things. Everybody says the Constitution is infallible. Well, I know it's not. It's been changed 27 times. Amendment, the very word means change.
Yep.
But the progress of these United States of America has been upward in terms of developing a more perfect union. But the point is, it's a union. The point is, we're living together. And we've got to solve our problems together. It's not every man for himself. If you want to live like that, you've got to move to Somalia and get a Jeep and get a lot of machine guns, because that's what it's about. Anyway, I'm pretty radical when it comes to that. But
you've made some good political speeches here. But I know that my listeners also want to talk a little bit about Axanar, because this is Fan Film Factor, although I've had a lot of fun discussing politics with you. So at this point, are you officially – well, first of all, have you gotten a haircut yet? That's the important thing.
I did get a haircut, as a matter of fact. I didn't get a haircut. I just cut it off myself.
Oh, okay. But save a little money. So you don't look like Samuel Clemens and Mark Twain with his crazy hair anymore. So are you officially on board for the last two episodes of the Axanar trilogy at this point?
Well, yeah, I am. I'm on board to the point of on November 3rd and 4th, I'm going to Atlanta to be in a con called,
Axicon.
Axicon, that's right. And I just worked this out with Alec. Here's the thing. There are so many, in politics and in show business, in anything that anybody ever tries to do, you've got naysayers out the wazoo. You've got, for every person who wants to create something, you've got 1,000 naysayers telling them it can't be done. I just read an article about Tesla, about Musk.
Elon Musk, yes.
Musk. I just read an article that he says he's stressed to the max, trying to overcome basically the naysayers that say he can't do everything that he does. He's going crazy trying to prove them wrong. And so it's hard enough to do anything, whether you're producing a show. That's the thing. It's so easy to make fun of bad films. It's so easy to make fun of bad plays. It's so easy to criticize. It is nearly impossible to create. And when people jump on a bandwagon of saying, for instance, Alec really screwed us, he's not producing with us, he fought a 2-year lawsuit with Paramount Pictures. And I don't know if people are familiar with Paramount, but the building holding the lawyers is a bigger building than the building holding the artist. and the guy who at the top of it, Les Moonves. Les Moonves was a Bucknell grad the year before I graduated. He probably saw me playing football for Bucknell. He is on the hook right now with the whole Me Too movement. Supposedly, allegedly, problems that he's had with sexual exploitation and whatnot in the past. I mean, you'd think they would be totally occupied with protecting Les or doing whatever they're trying to do there. But to basically put so much pressure on a project that will not make a profit for anybody, but only is being done because it was one man's dream, and it was not a commercial venture, is appalling to me. I know he was trying to do a studio, and he finally put something together down in Atlanta, which is where I'm going to do the subsequent 15-minute thing and probably two 15-minute things. But from everything that I saw, there was no money going into Alex's pocket. There was money going in. He did it, making it even that 20-minute thing. I read the script, and I said to Alex, I said, you know, Prelude to Axanar, I said, this is impossible. You've got talking heads about an event that is fictitious in the first place. How can this possibly work? And I called back the next day after I thought about it, and I said, you know, it possibly could work. But then I went down for only 2 days to Los Angeles because I lived, I think I was still in New, I was in New York. Where was I? I forget. Anyway, I went down to L.A. I shot 2 days, a weekend, Saturday to Sunday, in a green screen enclosure, and shot my scenes. And what I noticed was that he did everything correctly. He used the professionals that had done Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Next Generation and whatnot, the Star Trek professionals to head up each division. And underneath them were volunteers. But the people that were be able to instruct them and lead each department, I'm saying costume, camera, camera loading, director of photography, set design, all those areas, everything, was led by people who had spent 20 years in the business and knew what they were doing. He paid them, and then they were staffed by volunteers who could learn from them this business of movie making. And it was as effective and as efficient as any production I've ever been a part of in Hollywood, any soundstage. So I said, he did it all right. He did it all the right way.
And you ascribe that to Alec Peters alone, or do you ascribe that to Alec working with other people? The reason I'm asking is that one of the things that the detractors have been trying to convince people of is that you and Gary Graham and Kate Vernon, that you have a generally negative or at best ambivalent opinion of Alec Peters, potentially that you don't trust him, you don't think he's very competent, you don't think he's a good writer, you don't think he's an executive producer with any skills, and that the only reason that you're coming back to do any more Axanar is just, you know, you're a working person and this is a gig. So that's what they're trying to sell.
None of that is true, in my opinion, for me. I really can only speak for me. I know Gary's coming back to do something with the X, and Gary and I are on the opposite end of the political spectrum. He is a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. I'm dyed-in-the-wool progressive. I won't say Democrat. But we're coming back. What I just told you about somebody doing it all the right way is that you never see that in Hollywood. That does not happen. You have incompetence all throughout every organization, and somebody drops the ball. What I saw happen, that 20-minute thing called Prelude to Axanar, was one person, Alec. Now, I'm not saying he's the best actor in the world. He surrounded himself with people that had been doing it for 20, 30 years. The actors, I mean, Tony Todd, brilliant, Kate, Gary, myself, everybody that was involved have been doing that. We're professionals, and that makes one aspect of the project, it lifts it up, and the acting. But that's not, acting can be completely compromised by direction. It can be completely compromised by lighting. It can be completely compromised by set design and sound. That's what people don't understand, to make sure that everything was, and costuming, make sure that everything was done correctly is an amazing talent. And that's why I said he made all the right decisions using professionals and then was able to staff it with people that loved it as much as he did. Obviously, I'm an Alec Peters supporter. And from what I saw and from what I know, which is not everything, this is what I believe, what I've said to you. As an executive producer, that was his job, and I have never seen anybody do that job better. Ira Behr is brilliant, and perhaps maybe Ira. Right. I don't know about his writing talent because he used the other person that was key was Christian Gossett. Christian Gossett was the director of Prelude to Axanar. He had worked under James Carpenter. Kristen Gossett was an artist, like Alien. Who directed Alien?
Ridley Scott.
Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott was an artist, was a storyboard artist. He would do his own storyboards. He would do his own brilliant artwork. And when he presented Alien to them, it was a $400,000 movie. And suddenly it became, they said, well, no, what you've drawn here, this is a multi-million dollar film. We'll do it. But he was able to capture incredible artwork on the pages. Kristen Gossett was also that quality, that level of artist. He did a graphic novel called Red Star, which is phenomenal artwork. And he wanted to make the leap from artist, from graphic novel writer, artist, to director. And he did a great job. He didn't pretend to know what he didn't know, and he depended on the actors who had been doing it for 30 years each to help him wherever they could, wherever we could. It was all fortuitous because everything worked out in really a compelling little piece that was made for next to nothing. It's like $80,000. In Hollywood, if that were done, it would probably be $2 or $3 million. We used to spend $2.5 to $3 million on every episode of Beach Coast 9. And to set it all up, rent the studio, rent the space, get the equipment, get the people, to do it for $80,000 is a miracle. And that's what people generally who are not in the business don't understand. They think that maybe sometimes you can't identify the difference between an amateur and a professional, but the professionals can, and we can put our finger right on what's wrong with that scene, what's wrong with that costume, what's wrong with that acting, what's wrong with the writing. That's what we've done all our lives.
So the upcoming two Axanar episodes, what I like to call the end of the Axanar trilogy, Kristen Gossett obviously will not be returning as director.
I know. It's a damn shame. I mean, you can't wait for 2 years.
Well, I think that there were some other issues that happened along the way. There's a little bit of bad blood there. But so now instead we have Paul Jenkins coming on. He, you know, obviously is a comic book writer. He's done some directing. He's worked with a lot of independent film people in Georgia. The governor actually even, you know, appointed him as the head of a commission on independent filmmaking.
Oh,
so are you looking forward to working with Paul, you know, or are you just lamenting the fact that Christian's not going to be around anymore?
No, well, I'm always lamenting the fact that Christian's not around, but I don't know Paul. I didn't know Christian. I didn't know Christian existed. And then we met and we worked together and you heard how I feel about it. The same thing could happen with Paul. I don't know Paul Jenkins at all, and I'm not a comic book person, so I don't know about the comic aspect. But I don't judge anybody before I've met them, and it's the work that we do. That'll be the telltale in that. There's no other way I can adjudicate.
Well, there's a number of other people coming back from the original prelude to Axanar. Mark Edward Lewis is coming back, and Milton Santiago is coming back. You know, and obviously Tobias Richter is going to be doing the special effects. Not that that really had any effect on you when you were doing your green screen stuff.
No, it didn't have a huge effect, but at the product, whoa. Yeah.
Yeah, man, I mean, Tobias just does the most amazing work.
Shout out to him,
and the Lightworks in Germany.
The spirit of Richard was in that, and we don't have that either, and that's a huge loss. That's a loss that people don't really understand yet. Richard Hatch will not be there, you know, obviously. Anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, his heart and his soul was in that.
His heart and soul, that's exactly right.
You know, not only was he Karn, but he was also Alex's mentor in all of that. He was Alex's acting instructor.
Yeah.
He helped work on the script. He really helped Alex develop Karn. You know, and I don't know, you probably know the story, that initially when Alex wanted Richard to be in it, you know, he's going to have Richard be one of the heroes, you know, possibly either Ramirez or even your part.
Right.
And Richard said, no, I want to be Karn. This is an interesting person. You know, this is the Japanese admiral at Midway. This is a fascinating character. And, you know, that, I think, made all the difference.
I agree with you completely. And they had, you know, Tony Todd brought the passion. He brought all, well, anyway, I love my character, but I really love Tony. Ramirez was fabulous. And he had the ability with that part to be honest in terms of rallying the warriors. You know, to rally people. That's a great gift. It's a great gift. And People can smell when it's not real. People can see when it's not real. To bring that off with honesty is massive. And we're missing Tony too. So yeah, what can I say?
So what do you think? I mean, have you read the final two scripts at this point?
No, I haven't seen anything.
Oh, okay. So they're going to film you, and you're just going to have to learn your lines from them with the airplane.
Well, they're not going to film me yet. This is just a convention. They're going to shoot probably sometime my stuff in January, I think.
We hadn't heard that officially yet, so I don't. that's a scoop. Alec, if you wanted to keep that secret.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's right, but I know that he was talking about filming the people in California, and then since I'm on the East Coast and he's on the East Coast, I could shoot at a different time with my stuff down there. So that's what that's the difference, and I just don't know when it is. Maybe it's December, but I don't think so. I just signed a contract to do. I'm doing Christmas Carol again here in the Ithaca area. I love playing Marley. I've done it several times now. I just love it.
Oh, you're just curmudgeon-y enough to make a good Marley.
I am. I'm just yes. Please let me help you, Scrooge, or I'll kick your ass right now.
You will be visited by three more ghosts.
You will be visited. Yes, I love it.
You do it much better than I do, which is why I'm a blogger and you're an actor.
Not necessarily.
Well, anyway, I mean, we're very excited, obviously, to have you back for the last of the two Axnar fan films. And anyway, I really do thank you for spending time talking about both politics and fan films. Somehow we were able to make that combination work.
Well, you did. You transitioned very, very facilely. I was really impressed. Excellent.
Well, I went to blogging school.
Oh, I got a master's in blogging.
I got my master's in blogging. No, I got my master's in psychology. Actually, I didn't get my master's. I got my bachelor's in psychology, and then I got a degree in art.
You were a psychology at Cornell.
Yeah, I was class of 89. I had Tom Gilovich as my faculty advisor.
Tom Gilovich?
Is he still around? He's got to still be at Cornell at this point.
Wow, I don't know. Yeah, I don't. The name does ring a bell, and I taught at Cornell briefly, for 4 years as adjunct faculty in the theater department. But that name certainly sounds familiar. I had a lot of psychology students. They would come over for 1 year of acting or whatever, and that was interesting. Maybe that's where I heard the name.
Oh, it could be. I every so often I catch Tom Gilovich's name on some psychology article in the news. You know,
right?
They just discovered such and such. Back when I was at Cornell, Tom had this really great study he was doing on sports teams. And he had determined that sports teams who wore black got penalized more often than ones that didn't. And what he was trying to figure out is it because black is easier to see? Is it because black is just, you know, subconsciously perceived by the refs as being a more aggressive color? You know, the Oakland Raiders were, you know, evil, so they got penalized more when they wore their black uniforms. Or did black make the players feel more aggressive because, you know, oh, I'm wearing black. I've got to be, you know, got to be tough, got to be scary, bully.
Yeah.
And what I realized is that was just an excuse for him to watch a lot of sports and get paid for it.
Well, unfortunately, he was at Cornell. Unless he was watching hockey or lacrosse, he wasn't having much fun.
True. Yes, if war were fought with hockey sticks, Cornell would be a superpower.
Exactly.
But, yeah, forget about football, though. You know, Cornell is not known for that.
Nope.
The Ivy League isn't necessarily known for football prowess.
No, there's very few of the big names. I could probably count them on one finger. Anyway.
But anyway, I do want to thank you for chatting with me today, and I guess I will see you in November because I will be at AXACON as well.
Oh, fantastic. We'll drink a drink to the Roddenberrys.
We will drink to the Roddenberrys. We will toast with blood wine.
You bet, man. Looking forward to it.